In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today, we get another perspective on the ongoing aerosol operations conducted in our atmosphere, the sustainability movement, and related cover-ups. Anti-geoengineering activists are not against taking care of the environment. They're not against designing lifestyles that are more harmonious to natural ecosystems. As many listeners know, what's very sneaky here is that the very topic of being environmentally mindful has been hijacked. The anti-geoengineering activists actually care deeply about the health of the environment, and that's why they're consistently sounding the alarm about manipulating the atmosphere and using electromagnetic technology to alter weather systems. This scam is a critical linchpin to quietly lock in the surveillance state and is steamrolling ahead under the United Nations Agenda for the 21st Century Protocol. Huge climate summits and conferences convene, resulting in global carbon tax systems. This is a sucker punch to the economies of countries worldwide recovering from recession or austerity. Meanwhile, we are to believe at this point that there is no weather control technology being used, only cloud seeding, and that Mother Nature is dying and retaliating with violent weather. Therefore, you, the individual, will be taxed. As past guest Andrew Hennessy had written, quote, "We have polluted the earth, destroyed our planet, started wars, and we should be punished," etc., etc. The blame gets laid at the door of we, the common people. We're joined today by Andrew Johnson, who runs the website checktheevidence.com. He's author of the book 9/11, Finding the Truth, which is free to download at his site. Andrew has done extensive research into what happened to the two towers on September 11, 2001, the manufactured wars on terror, free energy, and climate engineering. He lives in North Yorkshire, England, and has worked as a software engineer but now works with disabled students, assessing them for higher education assistance. Andrew, welcome to Another News.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you live in the UK, and I noticed for some reason that region is heavily laden with trails in the sky. But if you would, can you tell listeners when you started to notice the excessive trails in the atmosphere?
Well, it was essentially really, I started to notice this around about 2004, 2005 particularly. It was in 2005 that I took a photograph of a grid which appeared just after sunset, about 9:45 in the evening. It was actually the 10th of June 2005, one of these tic-tac-toe grids right outside my sort of office room, if you call it that. And I sent that to Coast to Coast, you know, the famous talk show website, and they posted it. And I think it was following that that I'd seen this grid right over my house. That's when I really started to take an interest in the trailing.
Well, if you would take us through the process of your awareness and then beginning to reach out to others and find more information on the topic.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it was essentially that which was probably the main starting point, although I'd become aware of the phenomenon, I think, before that. And so at that point, I was curious to know which flights had made these trails. But it was still a little while after that that I started to make inquiries, because initially I didn't really know, you know, who to ask. But then I came across the Civil Aviation Authority, and I thought, oh, maybe I can ask them. So I gave them the date and the location of these where I took this photograph, and I basically wrote to them and said, do you have any records of flights, you know, going over this area for that time and date? They wrote back to me and said, no, we don't. You know, why don't you write to the National Air Traffic Service? And I wrote to them, but I basically got an unintelligible response back. I don't know whether they gave me the wrong email address. And I didn't really follow it up at that point, because I didn't really feel that I was going to get any satisfactory answers to these questions about the trails. And I'd written an article about the trails as well, and I discovered, I think something we might talk a bit more about later, the possible connection to Orgone Energy. And I'd read in a couple of web pages, for example, that people were able to dissipate some of these trails using these cloud busters, which I thought was quite interesting. Now, I didn't get to building one of these myself because you do need some good tools and a sort of a jigsaw and things like that, which I didn't have, and they're not exactly cheap to make either, so I didn't go to that length of doing it. But I continued to watch the trails, and I took photographs periodically, especially when there was very, very heavy trailing, or I saw these grids, the formations, which are still a bit of a mystery to me. And so I catalogued that over a number of years. Essentially, what I ended up doing, when was it? It was 2007, when I felt I wasn't getting any official answers. I compiled a sort of report as best I could. By that time, I'd sort of contacted a few other people in the UK who'd also done the same sort of thing as I had. They'd taken pictures, particularly the grids, and they'd become concerned, you know, that there were these toxic chemicals being sprayed and so forth, as had I. You know, I was a little bit concerned about that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I compiled this report, which I think ended up being about 20 or 30 pages or something, and put a lot of these images in it and asked some questions, and asked, what is this aerosol spraying? And I actually used that expression in this report. And I sent that to the Royal Air Force, I sent it to the Civil Aviation Authority, I sent it to some environmental groups, just to see what reaction I get. And I also got these people that had sent me some of the images, I got them to sort of countersign it as concerned individuals, so that whoever read this report would realise that it wasn't just me, you know, that there was actually, I think I got about 19 people or something like that to sign this report. And that, as I say, was in 2007. I'd written a few more letters in between times, but I still hadn't got any answers about what these trails actually were, you know, and what the flights that caused them actually were. So I was still in the dark about that.
Okay, this was around 2007, so it's interesting because I was also building awareness and learning more about this and trying to connect with others to create a body of investigative work to present to a government agency or a private agency. So it was a very interesting time, but I had gone to, at that point, I had gone to a geoengineering meeting with Ken Caldera, David Keith, and a few other geoengineering scientists who were talking about this in San Jose. Premise was, we're going to begin to start geoengineering. We're going to propose this as a backup plan to stave off the warming of the planet because of the continued reliance on fossil fuel. That was basically the outline.
Yeah.
This is 2007, just to put a context there.
Mm. Things were going through my mind at that time as well, and I'd put together a presentation where I'd collated some of the information that I'd had by that time, and for example, quite a lot of work had been done by Clifford Carnicom, whose name I'm sure you're very familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And I put some of his information into this presentation, and I think I had a clip of William Thomas, who'd written a book called Chemtrails Confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
I think he wrote that in year 2000. So, I was listening to people like that. And then, of course, there was Nick Begich, who I later met. I met Nick Begich in 2012, and I asked him some questions then, because a question had arisen in about 2006 that I'd had with Nick Begich, which I think is relevant. I can perhaps go into that later if we get time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think perhaps we were following sort of similar and quite parallel paths at that time. And I probably like yourself, I didn't really get much response. I'd written to the Greenpeace environmental group, and they claimed that they didn't have time to investigate the phenomenon. And I kind of thought, well, the first thing to do is observe it. You know, everyone's got time to observe it. You just sort of, if you're working in an office, you go out, in your lunch break and look up at the sky and see what you can see. It's not difficult to observe this phenomenon, whatever it actually is. It's very easy to observe it if you just pay attention for a couple of weeks.
Did you put together back then, around 2007, the connection with the warming of the planet and...
That probably came for me a little bit later, because I didn't start to hear about this solar radiation management, I think, probably until about 2009. One thing I will say is that around about that time, sort of 2008, 2009, might have even been a couple of years earlier, I became aware that there was some equipment that you could buy, and it was here. It was called the SBS1, I think it was called, if I remember rightly. I've written quite a lengthy article about this on my website, and this was a device which basically had a radio aerial on it, and it could detect what is called ADS-B, which stands for Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast. That is a signal which many aircraft broadcast down to the ground, and it's meant to operate like a virtual radar signal. And the box that you could buy, this SBS-1, which wasn't cheap, you know, I think it was about $700, something like that. And I didn't buy one at that point. That came a bit later. And you can plug this into your laptop or computer, and it would decode the ADS-B signal and then display that information on your screen, you know, on a virtual radar screen, so you can actually see where these aircraft were and track them. So I became quite intrigued by this, and I think as I became more and more curious and still wasn't getting answers, you know, about where these planes were coming from, I gradually got to the point where I thought, well, I'm going to have to buy one of these things. And a slightly cheaper version had come out, and it was more compact as well, and it was called the AirNav Radar Box. So I ended up getting one of those. I think it was at the end of 2009 or early 2010 when I got this thing. It was very compact. You could just plug it into your laptop, and the software that came with it was pretty good. And the thing that was quite useful in the software is that you could actually set a log file going so that you could track, you know, you could just leave it running, and then it will capture all the data that came from all these aircraft. And so you could actually track the aircraft, you know, that were coming over your house while you weren't there. You know, you didn't have to sort of sit in front of it and watch. You could go back to it later, and in theory, you could look at this this log file, you know, to sort of work out what planes had gone over. So I then thought, well, I can leave this running, and then if I see some trails, you know, I can then go back to the log file and try and work out, you know, what planes have actually done the trailing. So I thought, this has got to be a good tool, you know. Mm-hmm. But as it turned out, that was a lot more difficult than it had first appeared, because, you know, I don't know what it's like where you are, but we certainly don't get the trails every day here. We perhaps get them, if you average it out, you probably get them about 3 or 4 days in 7, something like that. And we have, perhaps like you do, quite a number of cloudy days where you can't see if there's any trails or not. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't really see clearly enough. So I'd left this thing running on a laptop, which I had to use the laptop some days when I was going out to do things, because it was like my mobile, you know, machine, as laptops are, of course. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't track them 24/7, 7 days a week. And this log file thing, although in principle you could track the aircraft, in practice it was difficult because it was just a raw text file, and if you left it running for a day, you get 100,000 lines of information in a single text file, which if you're trying to find, you know, aircraft data, picking it out of 100,000 lines, you can imagine what sort of a task that was. And I ended up writing a little bit of software to decode the log file and produce a sort of graphical output using Microsoft Excel, you know, the software. And that sort of worked a bit, but then it still meant that I had to, you know, I'd got all this aircraft data, but I didn't necessarily have any pictures of the trails. And I was having to, you know, when I had a free afternoon, when I wasn't working, I'd, you know, go out into the back garden, look around, see if I could see any trails, make sure my tracker was running. And then I'd have I had a Canon SX20 camera, which has a 20 times good quality zoom lens and a 12 megapixel sensor. So that meant that in theory I could capture these trails, you know, and I could identify the aircraft, and I could photograph the aircraft, and I could photograph the trails. And lo and behold, I managed in March 2010, which is now 6 years ago, almost to the day, in fact, to capture an EasyJet aircraft, which is a budget airline we have in the UK and in Europe. It was a Boeing, it was an Airbus A111 aircraft. And I caught it laying a trail down, and I videoed this trail, and the aircraft was travelling, I think, at 32,000 feet, and it was travelling at 500 knots, or 520 knots, or something. I can't remember the exact figures. But this is all on my website, and I wrote all this up. And I put up the pictures, and I identified the type of aircraft, and I photographed the trail, and then I photographed another aircraft an hour later, and it was the same type of aircraft. It was the same airline, EasyJet. It was the same altitude, same speed, pretty much within about 5 or 10% of the original one. And it wasn't leaving a trail. So I got all this data together from the files and from the photographs, and I sent it to EasyJet by post. And I said, why does this jet have a trail and this one not have a trail? Because, you know, same type of aircraft, etc., same day, same height, same speed. What's happening here? Can you tell me? And I didn't receive a response. They just didn't even bother to write back. So I then sent that information by email or through their website. And again, they just, they responded, but they said, we cannot answer your operational query. So again, I wasn't getting any answers. But at least I'd managed to identify the aircraft, you know, and I'd managed to identify that it was leaving a trail. Well, one of them was and one of them wasn't.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't give you an answer necessarily.
And correct.
Did you ever get an answer on this particular question?
Not on this particular question. No, I didn't get an answer, and I still haven't got one. And I'm still not sure exactly what's going on. You know, I haven't received a satisfactory answer from anybody. That page has been up on my website for almost 6 years now. And nobody's commented to give me an explanation of what this was, you know, why we had this phenomena of the one aircraft leaving a trail and the other one not. You know, so I still don't know what that was. But that, again, I was still thinking about this in my mind. And in the meantime, I'd been to this meeting in London that happened at the end of 2009 at the Royal Society, which was called Geoengineering, Taking Control of Our Planet's Climate. And this sounds similar to the meeting that you went to, where they were talking about solar radiation management being a cure-all for this global warming con, you know, which is a giant, horrendous con, which is still ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
David Keith was there. He was there. He was one of the guys who was sort of strutting around the place as if he knew everything, you know.
Yes.
So they were pushing that then. They were pushing this solar radiation management idea. And, of course, they weren't saying that anybody was doing it. This was a thing. They were saying that this was a proposal. And they had this thing called the Solar Radiation Management Governance Initiative, SRMGI. And this was like a sort of a public consultation.
This is 4 years later. You're talking about 4 years later. But in 2006,
right.
I was in a meeting, attending a public meeting with David Keith, Ken Caldera, and other scientists. And they were talking about geoengineering as a proposal as well. And so here we are 4 years later. You're seeing the trails in the sky, and they're saying, we're not doing it. And this is 2010. I just want to lay that context out there.
Right, right. I mean, that's right. A lot of people on the web have been talking about these very things, that, yes, they're claiming that these are all research proposals, you know, for the solar radiation management. And I think David Keith has this paper, which has become sort of fairly well known, I think, in those that are studying this phenomenon, where, you know, we talked about this earlier, where he was proposing this solution where you'd have these barium titanate discs, micro discs or nano discs whatever he called them, which I think were 10 microns across. So very, very small particles. But the property that Keith argued with this particular compound was that it would essentially levitate in the atmosphere because of an electrical field that's up there. So you could put these barium titanate discs up, and reflect sunlight. That was the basic idea. And then there was other schemes, such as the one by Dr. Salter, where he was proposing that on the same sort of tack as David Keith. He was proposing, for example, you could send out these little robotic ships onto the ocean, and they would be solar powered, and they would suck up seawater and then use solar energy to evaporate the water to create more clouds, and that again would reflect the sunlight to cool the planet down. Of course, you have all these schemes which are based on this idea that the planet is warming up, which is a highly questionable conclusion anyway, as perhaps you well know. So, I became familiar with those things, and I questioned a few people at this meeting, because by 2009, I'd already become aware of Dr. Judy Wood's research into, for example, what appears to be an instance of geoengineering on 9/11, which I think is some of the strongest evidence that's available of historic geoengineering. And, we'll talk about that a bit later. Going back to the trailing issue, I'd still, maintained this interest. I'd kept sort of looking at it and revisiting it. And I think it was 2012, where the next sort of stage happened for me, in that I'd got this little sort of credit card-sized computer. It's called a Raspberry Pi, which has become very, very popular in the UK and the USA. Mm-hmm. And it's actually become the best-selling British computer of all time. They've now sold over 5 million of them worldwide. And it's a little, it's basically, to give people an idea of what it actually is, it's like the guts of a mobile phone, a modern mobile smartphone, with a powerful, it's called an SoC, a system on a chip. So it's got ROM, RAM, and a graphics processor and a central processing unit all on one chip. And it's basically, the power of a desktop computer from maybe 10, 15 years ago, just on a little tiny board. And it's got four USB ports, or the current version has. So I thought, well, this tracking box, because I still had this problem with the laptop, I thought, the plain tracking box, can I plug that into this Raspberry Pi that I've just bought and use that instead of my laptop that I can free up for my other usage? But in doing that investigation, I found that you could do even better than that, because there was a little 10-pound USB stick that you could buy, like $15 or so. And it was actually meant to receive digital TV. But somebody, I just stumbled across this, had worked out that you could receive these ADS-B messages from, using this stick. It would decode those. And you could then bring those into the Raspberry Pi and do whatever you wanted with the data that had come from the aircraft. And so I had then had a system which cost about, $60 or $70. And so I was able to build my own tracker using software that somebody else had already written. Mm-hmm. The thing that I wanted to do was count aircraft. So I had this idea that what I would do is I would count the aircraft, because the previous tracker, I couldn't really count the aircraft. It was very, very difficult to do that. But with this system, I could customize the software, which was written in C, the C programming language, and I was able to customize that software and get it to count all the aircraft. Log all this information to files, various files. Not only that, a later development allowed me to attach a camera, a custom camera, which was made for the Raspberry Pi, and then I could take a photograph of the sky out of my office room window every 30 seconds or every minute. I can't remember. I think I did it every minute. So every minute I'd get a photograph taken automatically, and that would be saved with all the other data. And I enhanced this over a period of time so that it would also generate time-lapse movies automatically. it'd take about 500 pictures in a day or something, or 600, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would generate a time-lapse movie for the whole day. So what I could then do is, at the end of a few days, I could go through all the data, I could look at the time-lapse movies very quickly, and I could see a whole day in like a minute, see if any trails were shown on the time-lapse movie, and then I knew which direction the camera was pointing, and I was able to look on the Raspberry Pi data, because I got it to generate all these charts, so I could see exactly where the aircraft had gone that it had tracked. So I could then match where the trail was to where the trail had appeared. So I could work out, you know, and I didn't have to sit and watch it. In other words, I didn't have to do anything other than just leave this thing running.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I had the time, I could go through the data and look at where all these trails were. And, you know, of course, this took about 6 months of development, because the software that originally somebody else had written, it didn't do all the things that I wanted it to do, so I had to customize it. But that was my job. I used to do that for a living, you know, way back when,
mm-hmm.
in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. So I you know, that's my bread and butter sort of thing. You know, I love doing that stuff. But so then I sort of expanded it a bit. And because these trackers were fairly cheap, I managed to get six of them in operation at the same time, pretty much.
Wow.
Across England. What I then did was I got these trackers around the United Kingdom. Automatically, after midnight, they would download their data to my tracker. So not only was I able to look at time-lapse movies for my location, I was able to look at them for five other locations as well. And so I was able to get a bit better picture as to what trails had been seen in what places and what aircraft had made them, if any. To me, you know, this was a very important thing to do because, you know, I know you spoke to Dr. Wood quite a lot. I was gathering my own data. It was totally independent. You know, it wasn't dependent on any web pages or websites. I was doing it all. You know, I was photographing the sky. It was tying it up with data that come directly from the aircraft, you know, onto my own hard drive. I thought there'd be a bit more interest in this project when I put the word out that this, you know, that I'd made these kits available. They cost about $100 to buy all the bits, and I put all that information up on my website and various forums and things and on Facebook. And I had very little interest. I had a couple of people. I had about five people that were interested. Some of those five didn't have enough money to buy the even $100 they didn't have, or they didn't have the technical know-how to help set it up. I could help them a bit, but really without going to their house. You know, it's a little bit tricky to set up. It's not impossible, but you do need a bit of technical knowledge. So, but there was very little interest to me. I was surprised at the lack of interest in this, because this was a way to try and marry up some of the trailing with aircraft data.
Were you able to distill some of this information and get an understanding of what's going on?
Well, a little bit, I think. I don't think it was. It's not what you'd call conclusive. But what I was able to establish, which I think is at least useful, is that when I count, because I, you know, went through quite a long process, which I've written up, and it's probably too long to go into describe it all here in this time we've got. But what I found out was that if you looked at the days when we had heavy trailing and you measured the amount of air traffic that the unit detected, and then you compared that to the days when we had very little trailing, and you looked at the number of aircraft that were counted on those days, there was actually very little difference in the figures. You know, it was almost undetectable. But what it seemed like is that the number of aircraft that my unit counted, that it had detected, you know, in certain parameters, was actually slightly lower on the days of heavy trailing. But it was often very difficult to marry up which flights were making the trails. I managed to do it a little bit in a few instances. And I got some interesting time-lapse videos as well. I've got a couple that I highlighted in the report that I wrote up, about three or four from the various locations. And there was one particular day, which was, I had a tracker running at my brother's house. He offered to run one for me in his bedroom, because these things aren't weatherproof. You know, you've got to have them inside. I didn't have a weatherproof setup for them, so they had to go in inside a house, you know, and look out of a window.
Mm-hmm.
But at my brother's house, I got a very good video, because I got all these grids and, you know, crossed formations on one particular day, and it became clear from the tracking, the aircraft that the unit tracked, there was no way that there was enough of them tracked to make all these trails, you know. What it becomes clear, I think, from looking at all the data that I got, is that you can't use this technology to track all the aircraft. There are some aircraft that are coming along which are not trackable for whatever reason. I don't know the reason exactly, and there could be various reasons, some of them technical and some of them sinister. You know, I don't really know the full answer to that.
That's very interesting. I wasn't sure what you were going to say here, because I suspected that a lot of it could have been commercial jets, and there would have been a field effect that allowed for the trails.
Yeah, so I was thinking about those sorts of questions as well. But what I sort of came to the conclusion of a little bit, so I thought, well, if you've got so many of these trails on certain days, but the amount of aircraft that are tracked by this unit, which doesn't track all the aircraft, if you look at the various information, it will tell you know about ADS-B, it will tell you that you're not necessarily going to be able to detect all these aircraft. You know, so I was thinking, are we getting days where we've got all these military flights, coming over and doing these trails? I mean, we don't have any information on this. So it's still a mystery. I was still mystified, and I still am mystified now, how these were getting these grids forming, you know. And I've now got pictures of circular trails on several days. You know, there's very little information on those as well. We haven't talked about what's in the trails or what's not in the trails, and it's not a separate question, but I think you've got to try and observe the patterns of trailing first and try and determine, as I did, you know, as much as you can about the actual patterns and what the aircraft movements are. If we can identify the aircraft movements and marry those up with the actual trailing, which from my, you know, research, and it is original research, this, it's very difficult to do that. It's very difficult to do that.
Andrew, what are your thoughts on the work of Dr. J. Marvin Herndon and his analysis of the coal fly ash raining down onto the surface?
Right, so that brings us onto the question of what's in the trails, which you know, a lot of people you know, are making assumptions about that, I think, and they're making assumptions which I think are too far. And I was probably guilty of this back in the days when I was really getting quite concerned about this phenomenon. Dr. Marvin Herndon, he's another chap that's looked into this. Now, I was sent a copy of his research paper, which I think was published about a year ago, as you say, about the coal fly ash. And I had a read through this first version. I think there's been two versions of it. And I must say, I wasn't really particularly impressed with the first version. I mean, I don't have a PhD, you know, so maybe I shouldn't comment, but when I looked at what he put together in that first version, he was talking a lot about fly ash, and then he talked about, I think, problems with disposal of this from power stations in India, I think it was, and he spent a bit of time talking about that. And I think he talked about a certain region of India which had a big problem with coal fly ash pollution, you know, either in the water supply or in the rivers or something. I can't remember the exact context. But when I read through this, it didn't seem to me that he'd satisfactorily connected this Indian coal fly ash problem with, you know, an aerial phenomenon. It seemed like he'd just written about that and then jumped to talking about trails in the sky without really connecting them. And then in the second version of the paper, I think he did try and do a sort of more, you know, detailed job of that, and that was a bit more interesting. But I still wasn't convinced from the data that he'd given that purely this idea of taking fly ash up, and does that explain all the trailing in the world? Does that explain all the trailing that I'm seeing here over England, or does it only affect the trails that are in India? I think Marvin Herndon's based in India, isn't he? Is that, do you know that? Or
I'm not really certain about that specifically.
I have a feeling he is based out there, you see. So, but just thinking about that for a minute, let's just suppose he's correct, and that we've got this cold flash somehow being, you know, put into this trailing program. Then to me, I think the most obvious thing is it would leave a residue. And this is one of the big problems I have, having, you know, we talked about how I first became aware of the trails. So I've been watching them for 10 years now and photographing them for 10 years, less so now, but I still will look and see if there's any unusual patterns. And, you know, I've lived in this house here just outside Derby in the UK. I've lived here for 17 years now, so it's quite a while, you know. Mm-hmm. And there are only a couple of days in that 17 years where I've gone out, you know, to our car. We have a car and, you know, two cars now, and we've got them on the front drive. And it's a semi-rural area where we live. It's not what you call a big city, but it's not in the middle of the country. It's not out in the boondocks or anything like that. And there are only a couple of days where I've actually seen any type of residue on the screen of our car, you know, which is one of the obvious places that you see it. And I have seen it on a couple of days, but typically this has been what appears to be, we do get occasionally get dust from the Sahara Desert blowing up here if the wind is carrying it from that direction. Oh, that's what we're told anyway.
Andrew, those are really good points, and I wonder if... Because you don't see residue, does that mean they're not aerosolizing coal fly ash and dumping it into the atmosphere?
Right.
It's hard to know that. But right. At least Dr. Marvin Herndon did that work and added it in as a PhD. By doing this, he was not well received by his peer group.
Well, possibly that's true. But again, if you look at his website, he has got some other heretical stuff on his website, not just to do with chemtrails. I mean, I think when we spoke earlier, we did talk a little bit about the Earth expansion stuff, and that was actually how I first heard of him, because I'd been looking into the expanding Earth, mainly the research of Dr. James Maxlow, and Marvin Herndon had also had a couple of articles about his theory about, I think he called it whole Earth decompression dynamics, which I found quite interesting, but I didn't really think it was that, you know, when I'd seen Maxlow's research and such, I didn't really think that Marvin Herndon had it right. And I did write to him about that, because I was putting this presentation together about the Earth expansion mm-hmm. stuff, but he never wrote back to me. Mm-hmm. For example, this paper about the fly ash, it was circulated among a group of chemtrail researchers and interested people that I've become a member of, called Sky Guards. They circulated that, and they were saying, oh, you know, how wonderful it was that it got published in this physics journal or something. I think it was one of the Indian ones, I think, if I remember rightly. But the thing, my tracking project, you know, the results of that didn't get circulated by anybody, you know. And indeed, that's only been published on my website, and nobody else has even written to me to ask if you know, they'd like to publish it, or if I'd like to repackage it or something like that for their website.
I don't understand it, and yeah. Hopefully, well, by getting this information out, you can get an increase in traffic.
Maybe, you know, I mean, that's not what I'm after, because I'm just after the answers. And if somebody you know, it's just that I was offering this data to people, and they didn't seem that interested. Well, not as interested as I thought they would be, basically. In the, I mean, obviously, the general public is doesn't really take much of interest, but in this, essentially, a group of peers, you would call it, they didn't seem interested, you know.
What you're able to do is identify the aircraft that are spraying. On spray days, you can tell that there are actually less aircraft that are identifiable. But there are some aircraft that are not identifiable, and most likely they could be leaving a persistent jet trail, or what some people call a chemtrail. There are some planes that are not identifiable.
Right. That's the basic gist of it, yes. You know, one of the difficulties with that is that what I really wanted to do, which I didn't really wasn't able to achieve, was to get one of these trackers running in a country that has more sunny days than we do, because the weather turned out to be a big problem here with getting good quality data.
I bet.
But I still felt that after, because I ran these things for about 6 or 9 months, not all of them all of the time, but I think I had something like, I think I had something like 300,000 observations with tracking data and pitch and images, you know, over a period of about 9 months. So I did count these up using, because I put it all, you know, I put it all into a big database so that I could query it, you see, and get all the information out I wanted. That was the, I put it into an Access database. So that was the easiest way of actually cross-referencing all these figures. You know, so this was raw data, and I think it would have been better quality data, and will be, you know, if you run it in a country that has better weather than we do. And I, you know, and I know a couple of people. There's a woman that lives in Spain. I'd written to her, and there's a chap that I know in Greece who lives out in Greece somewhere. You know, he's interested in the chemtrail phenomenon, and but you know, didn't really seem that interested in getting this going.
Well, hopefully that changes. I think it's valuable information. In a past interview with Dr. Judy Wood, we talked about field effects surrounding violent weather, and you had mentioned in a previous conversation that there are, you know, possibly Oregon energy field effects created in the atmosphere when you see some of the persistent jet trails or chemtrails. Yeah. Could you talk more about that?
Yes, certainly. I think, you know, we've sort of touched on what's in the trails. Everyone wants to know what's in the trails, and my answer to that is I don't know. But what I'd more recently, maybe in the last sort of 3 or 4 years, whilst doing all this, you know, Raspberry Pi stuff and thinking about what I was seeing, what I was finding, what I was looking at, and just mulling that over slowly, I began to wonder if at least some of the trails, maybe even the majority of the trails, and that doesn't mean, when I say majority, it doesn't mean all of them, maybe what we're seeing is actually a side effect and not the actual cause, as it were. So in other words, what I'm saying is maybe many of these trails are actually ordinary aircraft exhaust, but what's happening is they are appearing in places and at times when they shouldn't really be appearing or they shouldn't be persisting. And that means that the conditions in the atmosphere have changed, you know, over the last, 20, 30, 40 years or something, you know, gradually or quickly even, to cause these trails to persist more frequently than they used to. But they are still, you know, made of water vapor primarily. And there aren't actually very many toxic chemicals in them at all, or at least the majority of the ones that we see aren't toxic. There may be some areas where they really are, you know, having some clandestine spraying program. I don't know. But the majority that we see and I've seen, you know, in the last 18 years of living here where I live now, and I don't appear to have suffered any toxic effects. We don't appear to have any, you know, wildlife dying off or anything, or flora and fauna. So are we seeing some type of extra precipitation of the trails or condensation of the trails because the atmosphere is being energized through energetic geoengineering modification? In other words, this idea of them actively doing solar radiation management with, you know, David Keith technology or some version of that, like Ken Caldera said, is actually disinformation. That's a diversion. And they're actually using some type of advanced energy-based technology. For example, and I've said this before, and it's purely my own speculation, you know, I'm just totally speculating here, that they're perhaps using some of the technology that Wilhelm Reich appears to have been experimenting with in the 1950s and 1960s, where he was experimenting with orgone energy and cloud busters. And you, if you can get hold of copies of his books, I think you'll find those an interesting read. And I'm wondering whether they've made a more advanced version of that, and it's been developed in a black program, and they're using that to modify the weather, you know, steer storm systems, make it rain when they want, make it drought conditions when they want. And that regular operation of that technology has the side effect of making these trails persist more frequently. And to me, that sort of ties in with this obvious program of normalizing the appearance of these trails. And I put a presentation together about this in 2014 where I'd sort of come to these general sort of conclusions that I've discussed with you now. And in that presentation, I've shown a couple of TV commercials and things like this where they've actually inserted aircraft trails. There's one of the most blatant ones to my mind. We have the tennis coverage here and on the BBC. It's, you know, we have the Wimbledon tennis tour, which I'm sure you guys will have heard of because it's often the US tennis players that win it. They had a new title sequence in 2013 with all the famous players, you know, Andy Murray and Roger Federer and Djokovic. They're all sort of get brief shots of them. But whenever you see the sky in this 30-second, 40-second sports program intro, you see a massive trails in the sky behind them, mm-hmm. every single shot.
Mm.
And to me, this is a clear example of subliminal suggestion that you know you see these trails in the sky. That's the normal sky. Don't think about it. And you know, most people wouldn't. They're watching a tennis program, and they're not going to be thinking about geoengineering, for heaven's sake. We've seen this in a few things like the Cars movie, the Disney Cars movie, the children's movie, which is all CGI. They put aircraft trails in the sky in that, and in the Over the Hedge movie. And there are several examples of this, and you see them on billboards and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it appears that they are trying to normalize the appearance of these trails, and indeed it works. Most people don't notice them. You know, you and I both know well that if we start talking about chemtrails or, you know, whatever term you care to give it, people just say, oh, that's just aircraft. You know, we have a load of aircraft. You know, we live in New York. You know, we've got flipping three airports. What do you expect, man, you know?
Right.
So that's what I think could be going on. In other words, the toxic spraying program, you know, I'm not convinced that I'm right on this, but I suspect I could be right. The talk of the toxic spraying program is something of a diversion from the idea that what you really should be looking out for as much as the trails are things like cloud anomalies. And I some of these videos that I got from the Raspberry Pi, at least one of them that comes to mind, probably a couple, have got some quite interesting cloud anomalies in them, which to me do indicate ongoing geoengineering activity whilst the video is actually being recorded.
I think you have really valuable information that needs to be understood by the anti-geoengineering groups here in the United States, and absorb it, put it into context of their work to keep moving forward.
Well, I hope so, yeah. And I mean, I'm happy for anyone to sort of discuss the further details with me, or, you know, if anyone looks at it on my website. So, you know, I made a 50-minute video where I go through all of this that I've been discussing in quite some detail. And that video alone took me about a week and a half or 2 weeks to edit it because of all the stuff that I'd put in it. And that's separate to the 2014 presentation that I mentioned. So, you know, for anybody that wants to study this, I'd be happy for them to do that and come back with any criticism or, you know, whatnot to me. You know, that'd be great. But one thing I wanted to add, though, was that, you know, people like Dane Wigington, who have talked a lot about geoengineering, and I think his website, for example, Geoengineering Watch, it probably gets 10 times the traffic that my website gets, at least. I've not actually checked the stats, but I think it probably would.
And your website is checktheevidence.com?
Correct. Website checktheevidence.com. And, you know, anybody that can't find what we're talking about, just click on the contact button and send me an email, and I can send you the links back if you can't find it. But if you put Raspberry Pi air traffic into your favorite search engine, and maybe my name, Raspberry Pi is spelled PI, and you put my name, you'll probably find the sort of links for that and stuff. But I can send anybody all the information. It's all on there. But one of the things I was going to say was this connection to 9/11 because of the Hurricane Erin data that Dr. Judy Wood discovered
mm-hmm.
in 2008. And this is another thing that very few of the people in the geoengineering community will talk about. And Dane Wigington apparently won't talk about it either. And as you and I have discussed, you know, He's been very disparaging towards Dr. Judy Wood's research, and frankly, he's misquoted it as well, which I think for somebody that, you know, what we're talking about geoengineering, we're talking about 9/11, We're talking about energy effects. I would have thought he'd be very, very interested in that and at least be able to say, well, you know, I'm not quite convinced about this, but, you know, maybe you need to give me some more time to study it. But unfortunately, he hasn't said that. You know, I'm only singling him out because he's often quoted, and I see his website regularly being reposted on Facebook, you know, and I use Facebook just like a lot of other people do. This group called Sky Guards, you know, I was basically challenging some of them to say, come on, look, you know, if you want evidence of ongoing geoengineering, you know, you've got this whole segment in Dr. Judy Wood's book. It's clear what...
Andrew, we should just briefly recap. The hurricane that was off the coast of the eastern United States, right near Long Island, was Hurricane Erin. And Dr. Judy Wood was pointing out that it more than likely was creating a static field, and she says a hurricane is a giant Tesla coil. The static field is suggested to be needed to create a field effect in which the radio frequency and interference zone could be created for various outcomes, including destruction.
You basically got it there, Jeff. That's right. I mean, it's an analogous to a Tesla coil because we have an electrical field associated with a big storm system like that. That's right. You know, whether that's exactly how they did it, we're not actually sure. I don't think Dr. Right. Judy Wood specifically says that. But yes, static field. Then you've got the Earth's magnetic field, which they appear to have been able to tweak somehow or do something with that, or just it being there. Then we have the possibility that microwaves were used as well, because we have reports being of people being heated anomalously in the towers. The whole movement of the hurricane storm system as well, you know, it was named on September the 1st. It hit Bermuda on the 7th, traveled in a straight line for 4 days, closest to New York City at 8 o'clock in the morning on 9/11. And then if you look at the other data Dr. Wood gathered for that, I think the temperature, the barometric pressure, and the humidity were all pretty much constant, I think, for 16 hours on 9/11. So you had like a highly stable weather environment for you know, several hours at a time, just as the events of 9/11 were unfolding. And dry thunder was reported at all three New York airports on 9/11, which indicates the electrical field did reach as far as New York, those effects there. So this is all documented, and I really become very, very frustrated that the people who talk about chemtrails and geoengineering, they don't talk about this. They don't seem to want to know. Perhaps it's because they feel that taking on the geoengineering issue and 9/11 together is too big for them. I know some people feel that, and they don't want to bring 9/11 into it because they'll just get called a conspiracy theorist or something. But no, we're talking about raw data which can be studied and checked, and we're not talking about conspiracy theories at all.
Indeed. Well, Andrew Johnson, I really appreciate the research work that you've done and the points that you've made in this interview, and I'd like to have you on back again to talk about UN Agenda 21 and some of the work of Stacy Lynn and sodium fluoride and the bigger picture of free energy, black technology, and climate engineering, because I think there's a lot more that you can talk about. So we only have an hour in the show. And Andrew Johnson, I want to thank you for bringing Dr. Judy Wood to the UK, in essence, and have her give great presentations out there and influence a great number of people. And also for developing the DVDs that WBAI uses for premiums. So that's been a big help, and not charging the station. I'm sure the listeners would also really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I just mentioned that wasn't entirely my own work. I did have a lot of help with all of those things. But yes, I did. I think you used the word facilitator, and that's probably accurate. Yeah.
Your website is checktheevidence.com. And to reach Andrew, listeners, go to the About page, and you can scroll down and find his email. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.
Thank you.